We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
Good morning. I think we need to peel back the curtain a little on this one, don't you think? I think so. I do. I first of all, good Sunday morning. I hope you are having a great day. The reason we need to peel back the curtain a little bit here is because this podcast with John Erlob has been in the can for about a month. In fact, hold on. Let me look at my calendar here. Friday. And by the way, normally I don't like to pull the curtain back this far. But we got to talk. You and I, we got to talk before you listen to this interview, right? And you need to know everything. I need to be honest with you. So on Friday, February, looks like that was the 6th. Friday, February 6th, I went to Rohrbach. And I interviewed Jen Newman and John Erlob. And, you know, obviously it's not that big of a secret. You listened to last week's podcast, and it's going to be in this one too. We did the interviews back to back. Literally, like, last week's interview with Jen and this week's interview with John, there was like 1 minute in between those interviews happening. It was basically, you know, hey, have a seat, John. Okay, here's your microphone, and here we go. So it really was kind of like a two-hour-long episode, right, that I just decided, instead of doing part one, part two, just decided to do let's do Jen featuring John, because John appeared a little bit in last week's episode. And then also in today's episode, you're going to hear John, and then you'll hear a little bit of Jen. So it's John featuring Jen, right? Okay. All right. All good. About 3 days ago, news breaks that Rohrbach has sold. That is fantastic news for everybody involved. Congratulations to John and his wife. Congratulations to their team. Congratulations to the guy who will now be the owner. From what I understand, it's either an employee or a group of employees, but it's basically long-term employee or employees who have been just kind of right hand the whole time. And I think that's awesome. I think John doing that is great. And that's really, really great news for everybody involved. Obviously, it's news I wish I had when I was recording this podcast with John. So it doesn't come up in this interview. So after John Erlob makes a major announcement, 3 days later, I release an interview with John. And we don't talk about the breaking news, which is, of course, why we are pulling back the curtain on the episode. And I'm telling you something that you already knew, which is these things are pre-recorded. In this case, an entire month ago, this was pre-recorded. So that's why, obviously, why that's not going to come up. Now, we do talk a little bit at the end here about what's coming up in the future. So I think you'll find it interesting what he says about that, knowing what we now know was happening in the background, right? Now, I will tell you this. I knew going into this interview that Rohrbach was if for sale is the right word. I don't even know if that's the right word, because the truth is all small businesses are for sale. I mean, you might say, what are you talking about, Paulie? Yeah, I have no interest in selling Craft Cannery, but if somebody walked in the door right now and said, I'll give you $1 billion, bro, I will have my office packed up in 30 minutes and be out of here, right? I mean, really, with small businesses, it's like, you know, if somebody comes around and throws out the right number, most of us would sell our business. I mean, and almost all of us, for a ridiculous amount of money. Don't act like you wouldn't sell your house for $1 billion, right? I mean, don't get me wrong here. So I knew John was maybe talking about what comes next. I had heard some things in the you know, through the grapevine behind the scenes that Rohrbach potentially had news coming. Just didn't realize it was going to happen 3 days before the podcast came out. So I'm still going to play it. I mean, I did the interview. It's still really good stuff, but it perhaps will be disappointing if you're clicking here thinking, oh, good, I get to hear this exclusive breaking news. That's not in this. Hopefully, I can get John back in the near future and do kind of a part two and talk about the acquisition, but I just wanted to come on and kind of pull back the curtain and give you a little insight as to, you know, I don't think it's breaking news that podcasts are pre-recorded, right? But just wanted to kind of, just an awkward, you know what I mean? It was just an awkward position to be in and not address. So I'm addressing it, and there you go. So that's the answer. And now, being said, still a fantastic episode. Wonderful man, John Erlob. You will hear a sprinkling of Jen Newman, who was such a hit last week, in this episode as well. I hope you enjoy the founder and former owner of Rohrbach Brewing, John Erlob. Geez, it's been a week, yeah, and look at us.
Wow, here we are.
Here we go. The magic. Ooh, this is why podcasting is so much better than radio. Back in radio, you had to actually come back in a week.
You know, the fact that you only have two mics is all right. Because this is a nice mic. It works, right? Dude, it's all about quality,
yeah.
Not quantity.
No, that's right. This whole contraption is like 11 years old.
Yeah.
And like it's $300 I have into it. I was speaking of Brother Weeze. I was listening to Brother Weeze's podcast.
Yep.
And he say put 20 grand. He just, you know, Weeze will tell you anything.
Yeah.
He put 20 grand into his podcast setup. I don't want to tell him I put $300 in. I'll freaking shoot his son.
Yeah. I'm like,
anyway.
It's nice. Yeah. And you bought it 11 years ago, so the quality's better than it is today.
Yeah. And right? You want to know what's crazy about it? It's called a Zoom. And,
really?
And now it's so confusing to people. But back then I used to be like, yeah, I got this Zoom recorder. Now I can't say. Maybe it's the same company. I don't even know. Anyway, I'm sorry. Thanks for having us up here in the John Erlob office.
Yeah, worldwide headquarters.
Worldwide Rohrbach headquarters. And you know what else
is great? I say that very sarcastically.
You know what else is great is I'm eating German food tonight. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's what coming out here. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. My experience was mostly Railroad Street.
Yes.
With your brand.
Yeah.
Because I was over there.
We opened this in 95.
Yeah.
I'm always amazed. Like totally. 30 years. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Just means I'm an old guy.
Yeah. Okay. I want to start, if I could, by one of the things I started with Jen on. The two of you have something in common you don't even know about, you probably don't care about, but to me, it's a really, really, really big deal. To me, you have this thing in common. And that is that there were about 10 or so people that I went to before I left radio, left a career, a 15-year career, to go into manufacturing sauce. There were about 10 people that I told about that ahead of time, and you were one of them.
Did they all encourage you, or?
Honestly, it was 100% everyone encouraged
Good.
Me.
Good. Yes. I just didn't want to get blamed for it.
You and I did a collaboration dinner on Railroad Street
yeah.
for like a charity or something.
Yeah.
And afterwards we're kind of cleaning up and I just had you for a second to myself. It was like we were just about to leave and I told you about this whole opportunity. I said,
I remember
this. You actually remember that?
It's oh yeah, okay if you know. Okay. For sure.
And you said, I told you the whole idea for Craft Cannery and that I would leave radio to do it. And you didn't even flinch. You went, you got to do it. Absolutely. And God, you know, somebody like you, if you had said to me, geez, you know, Paul, I don't know if that's the smartest move. You could have crushed the whole thing right there in that moment.
Yeah.
But you encouraged me.
Well, and I'm glad you did it. I think you got to try. You were young. You were passionate. I knew your products, which I think were great. That helps, right?
Yeah.
So, I just really think you got to do it. And I think when you're young, my dad even told me this. You know, he said, John, you're a smart enough guy. If it fails, it's not the end of the world, right? And I didn't tell you that. I knew you'd be successful.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's really good to be encouraged. I know when I first got in the business, one of the guys that I worked for, which will remain unnamed, he thought it was the worst idea ever because it was a restaurant. restaurant business. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even competition. He was being very sincere. He said, John, you don't want to do that. You know, I was working for Kodak at the time. He says, you got a good career. What are you, crazy?
Yeah.
But most people encourage.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad you did it. Can I ask you, how are things? Are they
good? Things are going good. Great. I'll give you more details off the air, but things are going pretty good. Great. I mean, don't get me wrong. I got a problem every day.
Yes.
But usually if I can get one bad thing every day and two good things every day, it's the right direction.
The right direction.
You know, yeah.
That's great.
Can I tell you another quick story about you that was so cool?
I have one for you, but go ahead.
All right. So I don't know if you'll remember this either, but it will kill me if you remember this, but there's this charity event.
It's the same story I was going to tell. Can I tell it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me tell.
Go ahead.
So anyway, and we did know each other, but not all that well.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So I even remember it as Ronald McDonald House, I think.
I think so.
I think that's what it was. But I at least consider myself pretty humble, and I think Polly is too. And there was this, you know, it was a live auction.
Yeah.
And we both had to do an experience. So ours was like maybe a brewery tour by the owner and maybe a food and beer dinner or some kind of tasting or whatever. And I was so embarrassed that no one would even bid on it, even $5, that I go in the back hallway and I said, I got to get away from this. Well, Polly's already there because his is coming up right after me. But he had like a dinner for 10 in your house. He was going to bring the food, cook the dinner. Well, mine went for maybe $400 or $500. I specifically remember it kept getting bidded up and up, and up. I think it was like $5,000.
You
had no reason to be back there.
If I could say it went for $4,200, and they sold two of them.
Yes,
and it was the first time I had ever done an auction item. I come around the corner, you're there, we see each other, and I just go, I can't be in the room. I am hyperventilating. I am so nervous. They're about to auction off this dinner with me, and it's going to be crickets. Not a single hand is going to go.
How embarrassing would that be?
People are going to be going, who? Why would we want that guy to make us dinner? It was incredible. And then you were just like,
I do remember you saying too, because we were. Well, I wasn't amazed, but you were amazed how much it went for. And you said, I'll do another. And the guy that offered like very close to the same said, we'll both take it.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that was cool.
That was so cool. So where are you actually born and raised? Where were you a kid?
Rochester.
Which school district? Oh, what area?
Penfield, but I went to St. Joe's and I went to Kearney.
Okay.
I'm a Kearney guy.
All right. And so what kind of kid were you? Like, what were you into? What was high school
sports,
John like?
Mostly sports.
Which sports?
I played a little guitar. Nice. Track and field at Kearney was my big thing. I played basketball for a while, and then the coach told me that I had to quit ski club or you're off the team, and I love skiing. So my basketball career didn't go very far.
You still ski at all?
All the time.
Good winter, huh?
Yeah, it's been a good winter.
Yeah.
Other than I'm a wimp now that I'm my age. So if like tomorrow morning, it's supposed to be 20 below or so. I hope I'm not messing up.
Oh, no, that's okay. That's all right.
Yeah,
we recorded this is like a month out by the time this actually comes out.
Yeah. It's going to be cold tomorrow, so I'm not sure I'm going out.
By the time this comes out, you know what? We're going to cross our fingers and say, you know, it's going to be 75 tomorrow.
Yeah.
I don't think this comes out until March, actually.
But I try not to. Anyway.
but anyway, so you're an athlete, but what kind of student are you? You good?
But I had to work really hard at it.
Yeah. Was it just you weren't interested in some things?
No. I didn't mind school. I'm not trying to be humble. I'm not that smart. I had to work hard at it.
Yeah.
But I got good grades because I did. I stuck with it. It was pretty good. And honestly, the teachers at Kearney really were great. Mm-hmm. I still am in touch with a bunch of them, and I try to help the school. And I think, I don't want to digress at all, but I think schools really changed. You know, there were a bunch of suburb kids that went to Kearney, and now it's much different. The demographics have changed a lot, and I think it's so great because it's kids from the city that honestly are given a special opportunity, and they all do really well. They go on to college, and I just think it's a great place.
So you do stuff with Kearney to this day?
Yeah.
I think that's cool because they got that kid, the NBA, plays for the Cavs now, Thomas Bryant.
I know.
And he comes back and does a camp every summer, too.
Yeah,
and I
just think pretty cool.
Anyone who went to that school has the greatest things to
you
say
know,
about it.
The sisters and the brothers used to live on the top floors. And, of course, there aren't any sisters and brothers anymore. So they turned into a hockey academy, too. Mm. And I think there's a girl on the USA team that went to Kearney.
Yeah, the Olympics and stuff.
So yeah, pretty cool.
So if I come up to you on graduation day, 12th grade, say, John, what are you going to be when you grow up?
Oh, in 12th grade,
yeah.
I was going to college, so that was good. I was going to be a corporate guy, I think. No, you know, actually, I did want to be an entrepreneur. But it was just I was going to follow my career. I was just going to try to be successful at whatever I did.
Well,
honestly, at 12th grade, I had no idea.
you said you were going to be an entrepreneur. Like, even at that point, you might have said that seems interesting one day. How did that even get into your, like, you know, well, how did you know about
I think just working for myself sounded better than working for somebody else.
Totally. Yeah.
Just that's it.
Yeah.
What did your parents
do?
My dad was worked for a construction company, did really well, actually built a lot of strong museum, and they did a lot of work at the Eastman Theater and stuff. So he did really well. Mom was a stay at home. We had four kids, so that's what they did.
So you end up going to college. Where'd you go?
St. Bonaventure.
And what'd you study?
Business, basically, finance and economics.
Yeah.
So business was kind of the direction I was going.
We're going to get into the importance of, you know, understanding your P&L and stuff here. But so that was just ingrained in you. You were good at that from day one.
Yeah.
Really good
at
understanding that. You graduate, and what's the first job?
Kodak.
I did between job and gig.
Yeah.
Jim, what's your first job?
It was Kodak.
Kodak?
You know, most people, and at the time, it was funny. I think I worked for him for about 8 years. And when I left, I said, wow, that must have been an easy decision. It really wasn't. Kodak was a great company.
Mm-hmm.
But and I was lucky because as soon as they caught on to me, they moved me. I'm saying that kiddingly, but I was really lucky. I started in Rochester, went to California, did a small time in Chicago, worked in New York City. I went to Europe for a couple of years, and it was all with Kodak. It was great. And the beauty of it is I do love Rochester, and I always did. My family's here. So I figured if I stayed long enough, eventually I would come back here.
What did
and
you
that's
do
what happened.
For Kodak? What
mostly,
was the actual job?
Mostly finance. Okay. You know, I originally was in the credit department in Los Angeles, and then all the other moves were kind of marketing and really marketing and sales.
Yeah.
So it kind of switched over.
What was it, the travel, though? Like, why did you have to travel for finance? Or I guess sales is probably when you start traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The finance was, credit departments were at each one of their regional offices.
Okay.
And I just happened to get Los Angeles, which was very cool.
What came naturally to you about sales? We're not in Rohrbach yet. We're back still, John, at Kodak. Like, why were you good at selling for Kodak?
You know, that's a really good question. The credit department was in the same office that all of the sales guys were. So I knew all the sales managers, and one of them talked to me and he said, yeah, I don't want to stay in finance. You got to get into sales. You got to get out and do it. And I had a good relationship with him, and he talked me into doing that. It was consumer sales. So I came back to Rochester. There was was called the marketing education department, or not department, education. It was out in Henrietta. Mm-hmm. But I came back for a few months, did that, and then they said I'd go back to LA, but I didn't. And I went to Chicago and on to there. And the Germany thing, I was really lucky because I was pretty young to take that position. It was basically all of the U.S. operations in Europe. I didn't run them, but I sold for the U.S. companies that would sell to military and any constellation or installation that had Kodak that bought from the States. And the person that was there wanted to come back into New York. So I just happened to be lucky.
Nice.
You know, he wanted my territory that was in Midtown Manhattan, and I got his territory.
Yeah. Well, you had Midtown Manhattan, and you were that's pretty cool, actually.
That was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it was consumer products. So I don't know if you remember 47th Street Photo. There were some huge operators, and it was really wild because it was just a funny time. They were bringing all this gray film in from Europe because it was cheaper. So they were huge accounts, but I didn't do – I mean, I did some business with them, anything they couldn't, but film we couldn't sell to them because they wanted – you know, we wanted them to buy the U.S. film, which was more expensive, and they brought it in from Europe.
What a bunch of cool different living experiences, too. I mean, L.A., Rochester, New York City, and then eventually Germany, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, you did so much. And this is your 20s, right?
Yeah.
This is 22 to like 30-ish maybe in there.
Yeah.
I mean, what a life to live at that time. Is there a girl in your life at that time, or are you just single John running around?
Yeah, no, there was.
Okay.
I met my wife at Bonaventure. I always tell a funny story. She was always one step behind me. You know, I begged her to come to California. Finally, she did. I get transferred to Chicago. I remember one weekend I brought her. We had the best time ever. And I took her to the airport. I said, so what do you think? She said, what do you think about what? I said, what do you think about moving to Chicago? It's not a chance. I love LA. So then finally New York. I finally talked her into it. And then once we got to Europe, you know, it was time to get married.
You know, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's lived in New York, Chicago, and LA, actually.
Yeah.
The big three. You had the big three.
Yeah,
what's
I was
your
lucky.
Compare and contrast a little bit? What's the who wins of the three?
Well, after growing up in Rochester, New York, and ending up maybe three blocks from the beach in LA, it was pretty special.
Yeah.
You know, it was when you're young and it was fun. And honestly, Patty was still in school. But New York City is like nowhere else in the world.
Uh-huh.
I love New York. I really did. I remember I said when I left, I got you know, we're heading to Germany. that sometime in my life I'll live in New York again. Now, at this stage in my life, I like to visit.
Uh-huh.
But it was fun.
I have a trade show coming up in a few weeks in New York. And just the way that just who's going where and who's doing what, I'm going alone. I'm doing this one alone.
Yeah.
And it's part of Taste New York, so I only have like a 2-foot kiosk. I don't have a little booth. So like I can do it alone, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, it would almost be ridiculous to have more than one person. I am so looking forward to 3 days by myself in New York City. I mean, I love my wife and children. I will miss them a ton, but they have FaceTime. And having 3 days alone in New York City, I can't wait.
It's a lot of fun. It is a great city. It's like nowhere. I've traveled pretty much around the world, but New York is New York. It's a special place.
So one more question before we get to beer. You go to Germany, and I've heard your story, and I know in Germany you encounter craft beer. But prior to that, did you have a relationship with beer at all? Were you a drinker? Did you like beer? What were you drinking?
Yeah, definitely was a drinker. Yeah, college, just pretty much cheap beer. But really, the craft beer stuff started earlier.
So okay.
I visited San Francisco. That wasn't really part of my area, but my cousins were there, or my aunt and uncle lived there, and I went to Anchor Steam, and I just thought, wow, after drinking, you know, basically domestic beer, this is pretty special. I thought it was really cool. And then by the time I got to New York, the Manhattan Brewery had just opened. That was one of the first brew pubs, I think, in the country. Garrett Oliver was the brewer. I thought, wow, this is great. And then Germany, honestly, it wasn't craft beer. It was German beer, which is just so good. You know, just fantastic. And it's really, I still think, is the beer capital of the world. I just thought the quality was great and stuff. So that's kind of where it all started.
And you fall in love with it there, right?
Yes, for sure. I thought it was really cool. But in my mind, I kept thinking the stuff that Manhattan Brewery was making and Anchor Steam seemed pretty special. Like the German beers, some I might like better than others, but they were all Pilsners, pretty much. You know, it didn't have the variety that you had in the States, or that was starting to happen in the States. And I'll just get into it. We get transferred back to Rochester. And I knew after 8 years, it was just time. And Kodak actually had an early retirement program. And they weren't looking to get rid of young guys like me, but they gave you cross education. So, you know, you could, I think it was like $5,000. You could get some kind of education, and they give you a little bit of severance, which again, I didn't have a lot, but there's a brewing school in Chicago. It's called the Siebel Institute. Kodak actually paid for me to go there. So I took the retirement because they offered it to everybody.
Wow.
They paid for me to go to Siebel.
You retired at 30?
Yeah, pretty much. 30, 31, maybe something like that. Yeah. I didn't retire though. Trust me.
I know.
A lot of hard work and years after that.
Was this because Kodak was starting to head down? Is that what
you know,
was happening?
They were, it was a challenging time. Yeah, okay, I think the disc camera came out. I don't think it did it what they wanted it to. So they were looking at just reducing workforce. Still a really solid company. It was way before the real troubles. Mm-hmm. But it was time for me to leave. And honestly, I didn't really know for sure what I wanted to do, but craft beer was kind of always in my mind. And I really wanted to just make craft beer. I didn't want to get into the restaurant business at first, but it was so early that I figured if we didn't somehow convince people to try our beer, like bring them in, come on in, have a great fish fry on a Friday night. And, oh, by the way, try our beer. You know, it would be hard. You know, how do you knock on Wegman's door and just say, hey, I got this great beer? And they're saying, craft beer? What? I mean, honestly, this was really early on. What is craft beer and who wants it? So we had to kind of build a reputation. We did it through the restaurant.
What was craft beer? What year is this, by the way?
It is 91.
This is 1990. What is the state of the industry at that point? I'm 8 years old. I don't remember.
Yeah, you young guys.
I'm sorry.
You know, I tell people to put it in perspective. There's close to 10,000 breweries now. I don't think we ever went over 10,000, but let's call it 9,000, 10,000 breweries in the United States. When we got our license, we were the 142nd active brewery in the United States.
Wow, yeah.
So it was pretty early. It was just kind of hard to find equipment. Finding raw materials and stuff was a challenge. I mean, a fun challenge. We found it, and we did it. I bought some used equipment from a place in, I think it was Connecticut. Mm-hmm. It was fun. We were off and running.
What about just convincing the public to try? I mean, you just said the food was the way to do it, but what did the public think of craft beer at that time? And who was running it? Was it just Budweiser at that time? Sam Adams existed, right? Like, what was around?
You know, I think, I remember there was a beer called New Amsterdam, which might have been made, I think Brooklyn was around. I think Great Lakes Brewing out of Cleveland was around. Okay. Anchor Steam was around. So it was funny. When we first opened, there were a couple of diehard guys that loved craft beer. I didn't even know they were out there. They showed up the day we opened, and they sat at the bar. They still tell me to this day, I was the first one to sit at your bar. And they were really into it. But honestly, there were a handful. Uh-huh. So it was kind of unique. But we were in the German House, which had been a number of restaurants before, and they tell you the worst thing you can do is buy a restaurant because it's all about location. And it was just the right fit for us. And that we had that location for 10 years, and it was a crazy 10 years.
What's the first beer on tap that day, you open your doors?
We dumped a few because we weren't perfect. Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah, I get it. Some we didn't want to serve, and I would say the rats were probably pretty happy the day that hit the sewer. But I think it was Highland Lager. Highland Lager was one of the first ones, and we kind of mirrored it off. We didn't want to go too far out there. You know, everybody talks about IPAs now and how much people love them. Well, when you're trying to convince people that are used to drinking Budweiser and Coors and maybe some of the Canadian beers, that'd be a big stretch. So we made something we kind of called a transitional beer, and the Highland Lager just had a little bit more flavor, wasn't super hoppy, pretty easy to drink.
You're getting in the restaurant business too, so I don't want to just talk about craft beer. You're going to start serving food. You have to learn this. Sounds like your passion was for the beer.
Yeah.
The food was just kind of like, this is how we're going to get people in. What were the school of hard knocks there, those first months, days, weeks, months of owning a restaurant? It seems really hard. I have a lot of friends, and man, they seem stressed out a lot.
It's a difficult business. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. The biggest thing, and it's funny, when you're new, you just have this wave of people that want to try you because you're new. Mm-hmm. You know, the key is, how do you keep some of those? Because some people just love trying the new place, and they could love the experience they had, but the next new place opens and they're going to be there and on to the next one and the next one. The first couple months, or almost 6 months, we were crazy busy. It was just making sure we could get the food out, staffed right. It was hard, but, you know, I always tell people it was from a business sense, it was the easiest because volume can make up for a lot of mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Our food costs were crazy. Yep. Our labor was out of sight, but we still were making some money because there were just people. We were busy. Yeah. And then it settled down, which it naturally will. And for the 10 years we were there, we were pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it changed a little. If you know the German House at all, it had a big auditorium upstairs. Never used it in the beginning. But the owner of the building, I didn't own the building, started renting it out so that there were other events. Parking became a little tough. So at the end, it was more difficult. And we had Buffalo Road. We had the location we currently have now. And we were doing good. I figured, let's just focus on that and try to do more wholesale.
So you had both?
We had both for quite a while.
Right on day one you had both?
Not in day one.
Okay.
Like 3 years later.
Okay, got it. German House was the original.
And we thought we built a brewery big enough to take care of wholesale. Mm. We didn't. I had like two or three accounts we couldn't keep up because we were selling so much at the restaurant, which was great.
Yeah.
You know, we had the retail markup. It was a good problem to have, but we really bought this Buffalo Road location. I was originally just looking for manufacturing space. And this building was available, and we said, you know, we kind of know how to do retail. We were at the German House location, pretty busy. You know, maybe we just replicate it and focus a little bit more on the beer, which is what we did out here.
I'm going to be ordering takeout tonight and bringing it home to me and my wife. And what I'm wondering, the next question is very selfish, if I could, just for a moment. What is on that menu today that was on that menu on day one? Because that's what I want to order.
Oh, you know, that's a really good question. So, Polly, honestly, like, it's Friday.
Yeah.
And our fish fries are unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
But I shouldn't say this, but I don't always recommend that because you got to have it fresh and sitting here.
Yeah, takeout's tough for fish fries.
I agree. It just is. And we do tons of it. And I'm always amazed. I hope they run home and eat it right away.
I know.
It's just not as good. But, you know, it's kind of simple. We Beef on Wick's still one of our best sellers.
Okay.
And a Reuben sandwich. I know that sounds crazy and that sounds more like lunch, but those two have been staples since day one.
Damn right.
We've got a really good rice bowl that I think you might like. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a winter rice bowl. It has some squash and stuff, and it's really nice. There's so many great items.
Cool.
Look at the menu. Don't have to order the originals.
I've been looking at the menu all week.
Yeah,
I know. I've been looking all week. I know.
Great.
I want some of those, the German
stuff. The German stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I'm at the freaking German restaurant. Yeah. I want to get German food.
And I have to tell you, the sausage and stuff, we get from Swan's. And I always give Barry a plug because I couldn't make the sauce. We couldn't make it ourselves. We got to buy it from the best. He's fantastic. Have you ever been to Swan's?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So you can get, you can go. I don't want to discourage you from going to Swan's, but everybody that loves it can get it here at Rohrbach's.
Yeah.
The schnitzels are good, but it's the same way. It's probably better to eat it here. You know, they're good, but a bratwurst is fantastic too.
So first few years, restaurant's going well. Beer, well, how's beer going? I mean, did you get right into stores? Like, distribution's going well? Everything? I mean, any roadblocks? Kind of sounds like it's going great, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely were. We had a self-distributor. A distributor wouldn't want us, you know. So we just had a little beat-up truck, and honestly, the margins weren't great on it because we were delivering it ourselves. We got into Frontier Field. It wasn't Frontier Field. It was Silver Stadium. So back in the day, and it was funny, once again, you know, these things happen that you just happen to be lucky. The concessionaire that was taking care of Silver Stadium at the time filed bankruptcy. So the year that we felt we had enough beer, we're kind of knocking on their door. And the Red Wings made the decision that food was so important. You know, you think it's all about what's on the field. Mm. I think we all know it's about the overall experience. Mm-hmm. And they interviewed a few concessionaires, and they said, we're going to do this ourselves, which no baseball does. And it's the only reason we got in. If it was through a concessionaire, they would never have let us into baseball. We had been there 10 years, and I remember seeing a trade magazine saying, why craft beer can't get into professional sports? I wrote them right away. I said, we've been doing this for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't me or that the product was that good. It was that the Red Wings felt they had to control it themselves. And we got one tap in the beer garden, which everybody thought was private. So we'd go to the games and tell people, hey, come on over here. It's not private. You know, we sold a few kegs or whatever, but it was good. And then we had a couple. Johnny Messner at Laws, which was right around the corner from us, that goes way back. But he put us on tap, and there were a few.
Yeah, yeah.
And with the production we had, we sold what we needed to.
Red Wings, if I could say, been working with them a little this off season. We'll see what comes of that. We'll see. Maybe
very cool
coming later.
Keep my fingers crossed.
But they have a chef team, right? A culinary director.
Yeah.
They still do it all themselves. And I was asking, how common is this? And I think they said we're one of three or four, or something like that. It's very rare to handle your own food.
You know, and I do think, and again, families are all different. You know, I had two girls. They love going to the baseball, but it wasn't what was on the field. It was what they could eat.
And
I remember we went up to see a Yankee game in Toronto, and we went to one of the concession stands, and they said, there's hot dogs and pizza here. What's at the next one? We go to the next one. It was hot dogs and pizza, and the next one.
Totally.
And they said, we want to go back to Frontier Field. We can get all these choices.
So it sounds like you're building and building, but it sounds like getting in with the Red Wings was a big point, right? That was a big, and obviously to this day, my goodness, right? That's, you guys are synonymous almost. It's just such a big deal. There's a few big leaps in here as you're growing. Getting the wide distribution, the grocery stores, the Wegmans, the Tops, did that all come naturally, or like did you pound on that door for a really long time? Were they open to craft beer? Now there's a ton of craft beer.
Was it
like that back then?
You know, it was different. I'll back up to the stadium too. It's not only the volume, it gave us credibility.
Yeah.
When you said, hey, we're at Frontier, at Silver Stadium at the time, or we transitioned over to Frontier Field, the bar owner that's thinking about putting you on tap said, oh yeah, I have that out there. Yeah, it's pretty good. So that was important. And the biggest thing is that putting beer in a keg is pretty simple for us, equipment-wise, you know, assets and what you need to buy. You know, by putting your products in cans and stuff, it's a pretty sophisticated thing. And putting in cans, or we did growlers because we really didn't have the money. And at the time, the industry, like the suppliers or the manufacturers of the equipment, they didn't make small canning lines or bottling lines. They did it for Jenny and stuff, these huge pieces of equipment that we didn't have the space for or the money. So growlers was the only way we could do it. And Wegmans agreed to put our growlers in their stores. I thought it was the craziest thing because it's not a convenient package, but that's what kind of started. Or actually, I think Beers of the World asked for it, Polly. Yeah. And then Wegman said, well, if it's a Beers of the World, do you want a few of our stores?
Yeah.
Well, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were doing it all by hand.
That was one of my secrets, too, by the way, is a store I really wanted to be in, like a Rubino's I did this with, I would just give them a couple cases, and then I would go to the other stores and say, well, Rubino's carries ours. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you need the resume. You need the resume. And that was one of my early tricks, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We actually make a beer for Rubino's, one of my favorite stores.
Yeah.
I hope you're in.
Is it the cannoli
of
beer?
Of course.
You guys do it?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Bro. Yeah. Hell yeah. Can we talk? I have been so freaking excited to nerd out about co-packing with you and running other people's stuff. What is the first time that it occurs to you, like, hey, I could also make beers for other brands here? When did that happen?
Well, you know, we really didn't have the capacity for a long time. You know, it's kind of funny. We always just kind of assumed we would grow 5 or 10% or whatever. There are breweries that can grow 50% in a year if they have the capacity. We never did. We kind of scheduled out and said, listen, we're going to put these extra tanks in. It's going to give us this much capacity. We were pretty much at capacity. The industry has changed a little bit, and a few people have knocked on our door. And the thing is, remember I said that it's very it's easy to put in draft, but it's hard to put in cans. Mm. A lot of smaller breweries would say, hey, we've got draft, but we can't find a way to put it in cans. And that's happened fairly recently. You know, we do private, like the Red Wing Red. I think people know Rohrbach does it. You know, that was one of the early ones.
Does it not say Rohrbach on it?
It does.
Oh, it does. Okay,
it's sold at our stands and stuff, but we don't push it. It's just Red Wing Red. You know. It is what it is. But the co-packing has worked out really well. I mean, there's certainly a demand for it. The whole situation with Young Lion is a little bit different for us because we're able to acquire the brand.
Yeah, so you own the intellectual property.
Yeah, so we really feel, you know, that we just have a special ownership.
Well, this thing that you're onto here is, I don't quite understand capacities. When you guys talk about like barrels and things, like, yep. I don't know how many barrels what equates to, but it sounds like you were offering co-packing solutions to smaller companies.
Yeah.
So if and correct me if I'm wrong, but if one of the biggest beer companies in the world, if freaking Budweiser came to you, hey, we need a co-packer. Can you run that? Or are you like, yeah, we specialize in craft beer?
Welcome to the world of Punches and Popcorn, where we dive into the bone-breaking and kung-fu-kicking world of martial arts cinema. Join us on The Path as we explore a new movie every episode, discussing the history, fighting styles, science, and more from a broad range of fight films. Everything from Bruce Lee to Jean-Claude Van Damme to John Wick. There's plenty of room in our temple of couch potato style. So listen in and subscribe to Punches and Popcorn on your favorite podcast app.
I'm Chris Lindstrom, the host of the Food About Town podcast. If you want to learn more about the Rochester food and drink scene and beyond, with a good dose of nerdery and personal stories on top, then Food About Town is for you. I've been writing and podcasting for over 10 years, and I'm so thankful for all the support from the community. Subscribe to the Food About Town podcast today and hear from the people that make and love the food and beverages you can't stop enjoying.
What am I trying to ask? I don't even know if I'm asking this question.
Paulie, you are. It's a little bit different. You know, they're going to want pasteurization and things that we can't do if you're really big. But it's more the little guys that want to get on somebody's shelf that really don't have the space, the assets, the,
bro,
fist bump. You know.
That's my business model, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my business.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing, too.
But, and I don't know if it's happened to you. Like, we've had some.
It's all happened to me. All the stuff. Yeah. All the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Is that where you're going with this?
Well, like, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, okay, go.
We get a brewery and we're making beer for them, and I won't mention any names. It's fine. We expect this to happen. But one day they kind of tell us, oh, by the way, we built our own brewery. And it's just like, wow.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that kind of hurts because you built up capacity and you're ready and they're gone. And you didn't do anything wrong. They said, oh, yours is great. But our margins aren't as good as if we make it ourselves. You actually help them get to that point. And then they become competition too. But it's all good. In the grand scheme of things, you know, I look back, even that situation you just mentioned, they got to be pretty big, and we were doing quite a bit of volume with them. Mm-hmm. But then I look back at, well, they were doing it for 4 or 5 years. That was good volume. It was good for our business. Mm-hmm. We got a little bump in the road. We got to get that volume back somehow, which we will, and I'm glad for them. You know, we had a good relationship. They didn't leave for any other reason than they got big enough, and we helped them get there, that they could buy their own stuff.
What has your strategy been over these years where all these brewery owners are coming to you and looking to you as a mentor? You know, I remember last week we had that Jen Newman chick on. She's still sitting here, by the way. But, you know, last week we had Jen on, and she's talking about that you were a mentor to her. People are asking you questions. So, and I've been in that position. I'm not trying to compare myself to you. You're John Erlob. You're a whole different freaking level. But I've had the position before where people ask me questions. It started to get borderline proprietary about like some of the secrets of how things go down. And every once in a while, I'm like, should I? And I have made decisions based on who I'm talking to. I'm going to tell this person everything I believe in this person.
Yes.
Versus, I'm going to keep my guard up around this person. I don't know about this one. What about you? How have you had that experience? You have to have been asked by a million people.
Yeah. You know, I enjoy it. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I try to be honest and upfront. And I also try to be honest and upfront and tell people the risks. You know, I don't want to candy coat it, but I also don't want to discourage them if that's something. And I think you're right, too. You have to know the person and evaluate them. And you really have to know whether you feel they have the ability to do it. If you don't think that they have the passion or the skills or what the drive to really make it happen, you really don't want to encourage them, right? Because you encourage them, it may not work out. You know, I don't worry too much about, and maybe I should, about competition per se. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give like trade secrets away, but I can give honest advice. I was just on the phone with another restaurateur, and we trade secrets all the time. But he's an honest guy. He's on the other side of town, and he's a very good friend. And I can ask him honestly, like we were talking about the delivery service. We still don't do it because we do a lot of pickup. And I really wanted his honest opinion. He was very honest about
that. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I had a guy one time left us a few years ago, came, said, oh, I went to another co-packer, found a better price. Can you beat this price, Paul? I said, I'm so sorry. I can't beat that price. Good luck. It's been great working with you. 3 or 4 months later, he says, hey, they're not quite getting it right. What kind of honey were you guys using in my product? And I go, I don't remember. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't remember what kind of. So every once in a while.
But that's he deserves that, right?
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. But as I look back in my career, the people that you have encouraged or that you work together, I love putting the pieces together. Like somebody's looking for something in particular, and I happen to know the person, whether it's through the Restaurant Association or just charities that you kind of say, listen, I can't write that check, but you might want to check with this person or whatever. Mm-hmm. When those things come to fruition, or like in Young Lion's case, you know, I'm sure she got into it. Great company, great brand, quality products that will live on for a long time. She just had opportunities. You know, someone knocked on her door and she had an opportunity to maybe walk away, not for any reason because she had great, great products, but I'm still really proud of what she did and what the company did. And it wasn't me. It's just at least I didn't discourage her. You know, it may have never happened if I really said, Jen, you're crazy. I love those things. And I think about the career or my career, those are the things that really matter. And the people that obviously that are working at Roarbox now, I've always felt that, you know, my biggest focus wasn't necessarily to make money. I just realized I loved what I did. And the last thing I wanted to do is to fail. Like my dad said, don't worry, you can fail. I work for somebody else. I didn't want to work for anybody else. I wanted to keep doing what I was doing. And then you kind of have the sense of pride. You know, I write a lot of paychecks every week. That makes a difference. You're taking care of families and stuff. It's pretty cool.
Isn't it kind of like a cheat code loving what you do? Because I'm with you on it. And people think we work hard. They don't realize that actually we don't feel like we're working. Sometimes it feels like work, but other times it doesn't. But the thing is, I wouldn't be anywhere else. I wouldn't have it any other way. If I had to go dig ditches, oh my God, I'd 20 hours a week, I'd be like, that's too many hours. I can't work 20 hours digging ditches. Yeah. But doing what I'm doing and doing 60, 80, 90-hour weeks, whatever it might be, it's like
I totally.
People say, oh my God, you worked an 80-hour week. How could you possibly work that hard? And I kind of feel like telling them it's because it didn't feel like I was working.
Yeah.
I felt like I was just living my life.
I totally agree. Yeah. I don't hide the fact I'm 67 and I'm still doing it because I love it.
Yeah.
But I always tell people too, even with the crazy hours, I love the flexibility. You know, I was able to coach the kids at 3 o'clock because, you know, if somebody say, well, we have the gym available at 3 o'clock, all the other dads, well, I'm working at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'd put my hand up and then I'd go back to work after coaching, you know,
totally.
And I'd work at night, but I still had that flexibility and I still, to this day, still love what I do.
I don't know enough about the beer world, but I'm sitting with the two biggest experts in the freaking world. The 90s, early 90s, I had always heard that there was kind of like a boom there as well for craft beer.
Yeah.
Did that have, I mean, what we're seeing today is something I want to ask you about eventually, but let's talk about the 90s one first. Did that have a similar thing as what we're seeing play out right now where it got saturated and kind of went away?
Yeah. You know, I think what happened was that there was a group of people that were really embraced craft beer and it kind of shot up. And then a lot of breweries kind of opened to try to follow it. And it just kind of plateaued. It just, we got our customers, we converted. I remember the Brewers Association was saying, if we could ever get to 10%, and we were at maybe, you know, as far as overall market share, we might have been at 3 or 4. And it just kind of got stuck there. Mm. And then all of a sudden it took off again. And This one's a little different because I think demographically, I think people are just consuming less alcohol. I think it's just a trend. I think the trend will continue. But I think craft beer, well, first of all, beer has been around forever. I think craft beer goes really well with food. I think it is a drink of moderation. It's not like drinking a shot. I think there's lots of competition out there with THC and cannabis and seltzers and ready-to-drink spirit drinks and stuff. But I just think that if we continue to make quality beer that goes well, again, goes well with food, is kind of a drink in moderation, it's a social thing too. People go out and have a pint of beer with their friends in a bar mm-hmm. and socialize. I think it'll always be around.
And they have special moments too. Yes. Like I'm actually meeting somebody at Rohrbach's tonight who, in a little bit. It's one of my day one employees has a young lady that he has fallen in love with. And I'm so honored by this. He wants me to meet her. And apparently they come here every Friday. And so I was like, I'm going to be there on Friday. Any chance you guys could come at 4:15? I want to have a beer with you guys. Yeah, so it's special moments. Everything happens over a beer. It always happens over a beer.
And so I think we're going to be fine. I think there will be, you know, people don't like to say it's a bubble. There were a lot of breweries that grew up pretty fast and quick. And now I think it will start to grow again. It might be flat. It might even be down a little bit. I think it will start to grow again. We just got to stick to quality. I think there will be a little bit of a shakeout. And I think that's just a natural progression. I mean, every industry kind of goes through it. We're going through a little bit of a hard time, but I'm very optimistic about the future.
But you saw it happen once before, though. I mean, I know you said they're a little different, but you saw the 90s one happen, right? What was your secret to surviving through the end of that 90s one?
Well, you know, you got to put everything in perspective. We were really small. And that's really the key. I didn't have the staff we have now or the size brewery we have now to kind of keep busy and volume and overhead. We were pretty small. And most of our business was really the restaurant business. Okay. So it was a little bit different at the time, I have to admit. And now we're finding ways. You know, we grew a little bit last year. And I consider that good as I look at my counterparts.
Totally.
And we're off to a great start so far this year. And Young Lion's going to be a big part of that. I think we're very optimistic about it.
Tell me about very unique. Railroad Street real quick, because we kind of skipped over whenever you finally go down to Railroad Street. You own that building too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Great old building.
Did you own
it
from day one? Buy that thing on day one?
Yeah. We were looking around because the brewery here wasn't big enough for production. So once again, we were looking at straight production. We ended up... You know, it was funny. I really wanted to go back to South Wedge. Love the South Wedge. But we couldn't find the right building. And then a friend called me. You know, things happen for a reason. So we tried really hard to South Wedge, couldn't do it. We ended up at the public market. And that is just, then at the time we bought that building, it was just very different than it is. The market's always been there. But it's just changed. There's so many places around there and people live in there now. It's crazy. I never thought we'd be able to do retail because I said at 5 o'clock, man, you almost want to get out of Dodge. It just wasn't necessarily the safest part of town. It's totally changed. We're very lucky.
What about the food concept? Because you went a different direction down there.
Yeah.
How did that all come to be? How did you decide, well, let's do this. Let's do the wood fire.
Well, again, I think Buffalo Road is focused on food first, and then we still are making beer here. We're making small batches, mostly for ourselves. We're doing a little bit of contract or co-pack. And then down there, the focus was the brewery, so that the restaurant piece of it, or I call it retail, was going to be a smaller piece. And we were never going to really do food because we just didn't think the neighborhood would support it. But, you know, we have Bitter Honey and Ziggy's and all the places at the market, Velvet Belly, and Fiamma's, it just kind of goes on and on. It's been really, really great. So we decided to open the beer hall, and we did want it to be a little bit more casual than Buffalo Road, which it is.
And one of the interesting stories I want to hear your perspective on is at some point this kid comes to you and he goes, I'm going to start a distillery, sir. Do you have any space for me? And like, and obviously that story now hasn't had a happy ending. But at the time, I mean, Jason with Black Button really blew up in your space, right? And like, what was that like seeing that this kid show up and go, I'm going to distill stuff. And then all of a sudden you're like, Jesus, built the hell out of a brand this kid did.
Yeah, he really did. Jason's a really smart guy. I really admire him. You know, kind of crazy what happened, and I don't blame him. It's just shifting the industry and timing, and those things happen. But we were lucky. I kind of heard he was looking at a building across the street. I said, who is this guy? Give me his number.
Yeah.
So he was living in Washington at the time, and my daughter was too. So I was down visiting her, and I chased him down. He had dinner with us, and I said, you got to at least look at my space, because the building now, we have totally occupied it. But you know, this is 15 years ago, probably, we had all sorts of space. I figured, what a perfect match. And I hope it was good for him too, but we shared some of our chillers and, you know, the boiler we tapped into. There were so many things that he was doing almost exactly the same. And he brought so many people that, you know, actually the draw was maybe more Black Button than it was Roarbox, but we benefited from that. So it was great. It was really cool.
Hell yeah. Okay. So you've already kind of touched on it, but I'm talking about this right now. What's going on with beer? It's been interesting, I guess, for you. You've lived it. This is for me sitting in this room and saying it's been interesting. I should shut the hell up. But you sitting behind this massive, well-loved brand. I mean, you are just ordained in Rochester, right? As Roarbach. Do you look at this? I mean, to what extent do you have to be worried about something like this? Or are you like, hey, I've been through this before. I got this. I see the future, baby.
No, you're always worried, and you're being very kind. I don't know that I would describe it that way.
Ordained.
But, you know, the thing is, everybody says, wow, you were the first. You should be great. Sometimes it's hard because the buzz is about the new guys in a lot of ways, and there is a group of people that kind of follow that. I do see it a little different of a trend. I think, you know, the fun thing about our business or our products is that people, they don't just drink it or consume it. They really, they kind of live it. They talk about it. Yeah. They share with their friends and, oh, I like this or I tried this. They tend to be very adventurous. I think some of that is changing. I think some of it's changing to, I still love my IPAs or I like a good Pilsner, but I trust certain brands. And the prices are to a point where if you're buying a four pack for $15 or $16, you don't want to make a mistake. So I think as you look at the pie, I think the piece of people that are dedicated to the craft brands that they like, I think is growing. On domestic beer, you always, if you're a Bud drinker, believe me, you don't like to drink Miller. You like Bud or you don't like Labatt. Very dedicated. Craft was different. People love to try new things. I think it's changing just a little bit. And I think that benefits our brand because I think, and Young Lion fits into that too. Young Lion is a trusted brand. I hope Roarbox is a trusted brand. Even if you didn't have our.
I think it is, bro.
If you've never had the Vanilla Porter, Roarbox makes it. Got to be decent. And that's all you can hope for. Or if you're an IPA drinker and you like Young Lion IPA or our Space Kitty, you know, you look around, you kind of say, I'm going to get something that I know. I don't want to be as adventurous. And I think that'll help us.
It's sort of a transferable thing. But when I was in radio, there was a metric called familiarity. And it was just that the fact that somebody knew it. And I'm talking about music here, like that, what will make a listener actually stay on your station. Just the fact that somebody knew it increased your chances that they were going to listen to your station, even if they didn't like it. Just the fact that they knew it. And it sounds a little bit like what you're talking about right now is just the fact that everybody knows it. They're familiar with it. You're trusted. You built this trusted brand. It's the foundation. I mean, making good beer, I don't want to say it's easy. I've never done it. I'm sitting in this room. I'm going to get my. I can't believe neither one of you have swung at me yet, by the way, sitting in this room saying, making good beer is easy. Making good beer, okay, let me change it. Making good sauce is easy. Building a brand is hard, really hard. And you've actually done it. And you did too, Jen. I'm sorry. Jen, who's. It's funny because to us, she's right here, but to them, it's been a week since she was anywhere. Can I ask you for co-packing advice real quick?
Sure.
So not thinking as the owner of Roarbach. Now just I want to ask you, just as a manufacturer, what are you looking for when you bring on a new client? What are some things you say? Green light, red light?
That's really a good question, Paulie. I think that at least for us, we'd like to have some kind of reputation. If it's a brand new person, it's a little bit tougher. And I should say this too, we have to have capacity. It is funny when you say that, and oh, maybe you have a lot. We have fermenters that are very expensive, and you only have so much fermentation space, and you want to make sure you allocate it. If someone says, you know, gives me a commitment for a lot of beer, but they have no track record, it's hard for me to make that capital investment.
Prepaid, John. It's called prepaid. Yeah. They got a prepaid.
I know. Yeah, but isn't it kind of a long-term thing, too?
Yeah, no,
so,
it is. Yeah,
like,
yeah,
for us, you could say, well, yeah, you got to, I guess they could buy the fermenter. We've never asked them to do that, but maybe they could. Then the risk is not as much.
I've gotten a few pieces of equipment that way, honestly.
That's pretty cool. But I do think that it is some kind of reputation, because if you're just going out of the chute and somebody says, listen, I got a great recipe for beer, I said a lot of people have a good recipe for beer. And you said it too. I think back in the day, making good beer could kind of carry the day, and you do have some good sales because, you know, the word would kind of get, oh, yeah, did you try that new whatever beer? It's pretty good, and it'll go. Now it is a lot about the brand and marketing and packaging and mm-hmm. the label and the relationships you have with your, we call it on-premise, which are bars and restaurants, or off-premise, which are the stores and the supermarkets. It's about relationships. Relationships are still a huge part of our business. And that's so exciting to me.
Yeah.
It's not all about the specs or even the beer, because there's so much good beer out there. It's how do you nurture that relationship? And now that we've admitted that Jen is still here, I think part of the reason the Young Lion is interesting to me, or interesting, why I think that brand can grow, is that while Jen has started her own career, the story behind it and her passion, and you know, you talk to people, you know, that even I don't have the relationship anywhere close. Like, I think I have a good relationship with Wegmans. She has an incredible relationship with, I mean, you know, right? It's her personality and how she is and stuff.
Everybody loves
and,
Jen.
And that still goes a long way. You know, it's about getting the chance. So we'll be able to get onto Wegman shelves and keep those spaces because of the relationship she developed. But then hopefully the product will, and I'm sure will, the product will sell through.
Real quick, just because we have to show proof of life, because people aren't going to believe she's actually still here. Just say hi.
Hi. Can I ask a question of John?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so we have to talk about Scotch Ale. So we haven't talked about Scotch Ale. When I got into the industry, so IPA was king and literally 40% of the market. And yet, in Rochester, the number one beer in all of Rochester was still the Scotch Ale, and the top in the country. So can it's a national, you know, pride for Rochester. Can we just talk about you start, because I don't know the story as well as I know you, but let's talk about Scotch Ale and how you built that to have that kind of, you know, true volume in Rochester and have that sort of national pride.
Yeah, Jen, thank you. Again, you get lucky sometimes. I mean, we never set out. I knew a brewery that, I'll just use an example. They just had this apricot wheat that they said, this is going to be our flagship. It's such a good beer. And they pushed it so hard. We never did that. We just made the best beer we could. And whoever, you know, whatever kind of raised to the top. And the reason it did so well is that if you look at the IPAs, everybody's cutting up the pie. Everybody's trying to get their little slice. And nobody was really focused on a malt-forward beer. So Scotch Ale, there weren't a lot of choices out there. They went with Rohrbach Scotch Ale, and I don't mean to minimize it. I think it's a great beer. We didn't totally follow. Like, the real Scotch Ale would be probably a little higher in alcohol, little alcoholic finish, a little bit different. Ours is a little bit sweeter, a little lower in ABV, easy to drink, which is what we wanted. We always want to kind of hit, you know, the top of the bell curve, not the domestic beers, but just something that's drinkable for people. We love to experiment with some crazy stuff, but you just focused on it. And honestly, Jen, it just raised to the top, and we just kept making it as long as people were drinking it.
You make it sound so easy, and yet it was such, I mean, what a pride for Rochester. And
it's
lucky that we have it. And Young Lion never made a Scotch Ale.
You're the best.
You know, just because, because we know Rochester.
I don't think you should be handing me the mic, but you just did the best part of the interview. Best part of the last 2 weeks was your question just now. I don't think I deserve it back. Okay, well, in last week's episode, though, Jen named you as a mentor. And I said, well, give me one nugget. What's one John Erlob nugget that just stuck with you? And she said it was P&L. It was just like slaving over your P&L, knowing that thing top to bottom.
Yep.
And finance guy, Kodak, right? We talked about it. It's your background. Yep. It comes naturally to you. P&L, we know that's been your big advice. Bring me, let's go freaking into the weeds for a second. Tell me, you pull up that P&L every day. What are your eyeballs? What are you going right at? What are you looking at?
You know, it's your big drivers, and there's not much you can do, but it really is raw materials. Mm-hmm. And we tried really hard to contract for that. Even though we might be paying a higher price, I want consistency. We don't do a whole lot of discounting, honestly. Top line, you have to look at. You know, top line is critically important. I am just hitting the big ones. Labor is really key too. And there's not much you can do to control that. I mean, we're a small company. It's not like the people come and go. You got to try to control overtime if you can. And in the restaurant business, there's a span, extra labor that you have to pay if people work doubles. We try not to do that, not only because of the extra cost, but it's hard on people. You know, sometimes you have to because you just don't have the staff, but we look pretty closely at that. Utilities we can control. I try to look at the things that I can control. Mm-hmm. There's certain things that I can't. You know, rent is what it is. It's going to be that way every month. So I don't look at that every day. But the other ones you really look at. And volume. And then you have to dig down. At the top line, you have to see where it's coming from. Or if it's not doing as well, where are the challenges? And you just have to dig down and spend the time to do it. Somebody told me the other day, it was actually a distributor. He said, you know, there's breweries out there that are just not making very good beer. We wouldn't be interested in them at all. And he said, there's other breweries that are out there that are making fantastic beer. And they're really good brewers and stuff, not really good business people. And he said, that doesn't work. He said, the people we're looking for is somebody that's focused on making good quality products, but know how to run a business. And you need to do that in anything. I can't tell you the chefs I know that are so good, so passionate about what they do. But if you don't know how to run the business, it's not going to turn out the way you want.
That's great advice, man, from the freaking master.
Yeah.
Feel like you were in
it's pretty
class
simple
just now? That was pretty good. So when you're looking down through your expenses, you just have percents in mind. I want my labor to run at X percent, blah, 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 all the way down. Yeah.
And you budget ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of see if it's off, because there will be times that are a little bit slower during the season. You can't just say, well, I'm slower than I was last week. Well, maybe that's the right thing, but how did you do to your budget? So you could take your time to really look at the budget and see if you're off, dig into it. And I think things do change, and you're never going to have a budget that's perfect. You're just not. But I think what you have to do is to be able to adjust quickly. I think when you have challenging times, it's a little bit slower. A lot of people get in trouble because they keep saying, well, it's going to turn around. It's just, you know, I don't have to cut staff yet, or I don't have to cut this cost, or I have to do this, or maybe reduce the advertising budget. And those are hard decisions to make, because advertising could negatively impact your top line. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to make those decisions quick enough before you get into a hole. Because I think some people do get into a hole, and they just don't react quick enough.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was just gonna repeat something, but I appreciate you doing this so much. This was really, really cool. Both of you guys, by the way.
It's fun.
What a fantastic opportunity to sit here and talk to you about this. Is there a succession plan? I mean, are there kids?
Well,
are there young Urlops?
Paulie, you want to buy a brewery?
You know, it's funny. Every once in a while, people ask me that too, and I'm like, listen, for the right number, I'll take the key off the chain right now.
I've said that all along. You know, I haven't been able to figure who I can give my letter of resignation to, but I'm getting closer.
That's a good line.
Kids both live out of town, and they're going to be way more successful than me anyway. So yeah, I did mention to him. I said, you know, at some point that something's got to give, and I don't want to like sell the brewery and have you say, oh, you never asked me. So we asked them both, and they both were interested. But I said, well, you got to move back pretty soon, because you can't just like take over one day when I'm ready to go. I said, you got to work with me for a while. And they both have great careers, and that probably won't happen. But, you know, we'll find the right solution. The most important for me for a succession is to make sure that the brand continues, the staff is taken care of, they're happy with it. You know, private equity is always one of those things that, you know, it's an easy trigger to pull, and you get a little bit of cash and you walk away. But it's usually not pretty in the long run, because they want to make their money and turn it over or whatever, and it's not good for the staff. So we've got some ideas, because I can't do this forever. But I do hope that whenever that day is, that I stay in it, because I still love what I do. And, you know, I'll come in. I told somebody once, he said, I'll just come in here and cut the lawn once in a while. I like doing that. As long as I don't have to pay bills anymore. It'll be like retiring.
Yeah. John, you're the best, man. Thank you so much for doing this.
It's been a pleasure, too, and I'm so glad to hear you're doing well. Great to catch up.
Because of you. Both of you guys. You could have squashed it back then, man, and you didn't, and I'm just so appreciative of that. So.
Yeah. Well, listen, everybody that's listening, grab a Young Lion, please, a Rohrbach beer. Keep us going and enjoy, right? Have fun with your friends.
Absolutely.
Your family.
What do I drink when I go over there? What should I order?
You know,
classic or something new. What do I
do? Well, Scotch ale, you can't miss it.
Yep.
But did you decide on? Are you going to get a beef on wick or a Reuben or?
Maybe I'd do a couple things. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Do you like IPAs at all? Like a lot of people don't. They'll come right out and they say they're too hoppy.
I like IPAs if I'm going to have a beer.
Yeah.
The only issue I have with all the shit that you guys are up to, is that like if it's Super Bowl Sunday and I'm gonna have a beer at noon and I'm expected to make it till 10 p.m., I can't do any of your beers because I'll die. But
We have a small batch. It's called Timberline.
Okay.
Which is kind of West Coast. Timberline is, you know, West Coast are more piney, a little bitter, but it's lower ABV too. It's really nice. Not too hoppy.
He had a song with Justin Timberlake once, Timberline. Remember that? The way Jen likes that joke.
Well, listen, don't get me in trouble. He'll come back at me with some kind of like copyright or I didn't get approval to use it's Timberline, like the trees.
Yeah. I know, Paul. I'm just kidding. Well, so that's what I should try over there?
I think you'd really like it.
Is that what I say? Like Timberline? Yeah. That's what I asked for?
Yeah, and okay. I hope you like this lady that you're going
to
meet.
I'm excited to meet her.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm excited. This, by the way, if somebody's just tuning in, that sounds terrible.
It's not somebody that you're meeting. You're meeting an employee's special girl.
OG employees. Like okay. This is like a guy who's been there since we were hand pouring every bottle.
Wow.
This is one of those guys who worked a few of those 12 and 14 hour days with me.
Wow.
I mean, I've got beautiful memories with this dude, and he was always, you know, young single bachelor guy. Then one day, all of a sudden, Samantha came around. I started hearing about Samantha. All of a sudden, Dan started cutting his hair more often. Yeah. All of a sudden, the goatee was getting quaffed.
Yeah.
Then one day, the goatee was gone.
You know, you were just saying about all the great memories you have with him. I'm sure the feeling's mutual. I'm sure he's going to say, "Paul, I miss being there those late nights." Cannon by hand.
I've pissed him off. You know what he just told me kind of like a few weeks ago is he said something he was always afraid to tell me until now is he could never believe how much energy I would have at like 5 a.m. Because I would come in at 5 a.m. Well, he would come in at 5, but I would already be there.
Yeah.
And he would come in and like the first thing, this is going to make me sound like such an asshole, but I think you'll both kind of understand, is he would show up at 5 and I would be like, this wasn't done. And he was like, how could you at 5 a.m. already be ready with the list of shit that wasn't done? Yeah.
Like, give me a break. Let me get my coffee.
It's like it's 5. Relax. Yeah. But anyway, all right. Well, thank you very much for doing this. You guys are great.
Yeah. My pleasure.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.